It's time to change the situation if Tottenham wants to change.
It's in the past, it's in the past. Then we look forward, buy our football positive. We're wearing Tottenham shirts, we play the Tottenham way.
And still Ricky Villa! What a fantastic run! He scored!
That's going to have a crack. He is, you know.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest edition of the Tottenham Way podcast. I am Marcus Buckland in the company of Tom Barkley from The Sun, who's not feeling very well. So we're going to be extra gentle with him. And Dan Kilpatrick of The Standard, who is actually blowing his nose as I introduce him. But I don't think he's as ill as Tom Barkley. I'm absolutely fine, having sat through El Crapico. I think that's the best way of describing Spurs against Manchester United in terms of quality. There can't have been many worse examples of a match between these two great teams in recent times. But Spurs picked up 3 points. I was chided by a lot of people when I said afterwards, yeah, pretty awful 90 minutes, but we got the result. We won. Okay, so I'm pleased about that. We had a couple of players back as well. So perhaps the future is looking just a little brighter. I am Marcus Buckland. I don't know if I said that, but I am. Dan, Tom, let's just start, before we go into a few details, with the overall performance. I don't think I'm being too harsh, Dan, in saying that, you know, in terms of the quality, it was disappointing. But I guess it was quite exciting from a purely neutral point of view. Bit of a basketball match in some ways, wasn't it? You go forward, then we'll go forward. And luckily, in the case of Manchester United, they had nobody who could capitalise when they went forward.
Yeah, I saw the frustrations, people saying it's the worst game of the season. But I thought, in terms of quality, it was poor, but in terms of entertainment, it was all right. Like, it was pretty end-to-end. There were lots of half chances for both sides. I think there were 35-odd shots across the course of the game from the two teams, although a lot of them were pretty low-quality half chances. So, yeah, it did just feel like a game where Spurs had to get the result, and the result was kind of the most important thing, particularly given this state United were in. I thought, on balance of big chances, Spurs just about shaded it, but they were probably lucky to get away with a clean sheet. I mean, Garnacho missed a great chance in the first half. Vicario made a couple of smart saves, and then the Xerxes header toward the end was also a really good opening. So my feeling was that if Diallo had been fit, Spurs probably would have conceded. But equally, I think, you know, if Solanke had been playing, Spurs would have capitalised on one of their counter-attacking opportunities in the second half that they squandered. So, yeah, you know, two teams kind of on their knees, kind of at different ends of a pretty bad injury crisis. But Spurs got the win. They've got back-to-back wins in the league now. They've got something to build on, and they've got another free week before facing Ipswich away next weekend, where you would expect them to kind of improve. Returning players get a bit fitter and sharper. Everyone gets a couple bit more time off and a bit more time on the training ground to kind of work on things. So can't complain too much, can we?
No, we can't. And actually, Tom B and seemed most excited about the fact that he'd had a whole week on the training pitch. Most of the players he said were back. We've had to train with the under-21s for the past couple of months. So he was back to his more chipper self afterwards. And obviously Vicario was back, Maddison was back. They both had a part to play. Do you see the shoots of recovery, or has that result just papered over all the cracks?
Somewhere in between, really. I mean, you say El Crapico. I think Sun's headline was Hell Classico. So it's not like you're the only person who feels that way in terms of the low and quality performance. You know, remember there's one particular air shot from Xerxes which almost seemed to sum up the game. But, and I do agree with Dan that if Diallo had been playing, that United would have had, I mean, they really shouldn't have lost that game from my perspective. They missed a lot of chances, and Vicario had a really, really good game in goal. But for Tottenham, I mean, it's like a building block to the future, isn't it? The first back-to-back win since September, I think, which I was ironically against Man United and Brentford as well. And given the sort of long, cold, difficult winter that they faced in the last few months, they were due a bit of luck, I suppose, in that game. And the difference between the two teams, as Amarin said afterwards, was that Spurs basically took their chance. And they did. And I feel like if they use this to build on, hence the building block sort of analogy, then it could be a sort of good start. But I don't think anyone's going to have been completely won over by that individual performance, thinking that everything is turned around dramatically from this one game.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it was great to have Vicario back. You know, there'll still be question marks, I'm sure, when teams try to pinpoint him from corners and set pieces in the future, but he did make some excellent saves. Maddison's interesting, Dan. He obviously scored the goal. He then celebrates with the darts routine, which apparently was a deliberate dig at Roy Keane. I mean, I'm not sure in the circumstances that was the best thing to do. There was a very interesting discussion on TalkSport as well this morning, where Simon Jordan in particular is obviously not a fan of Maddison's and says Spurs are never going to win anything with him in the team. I mean, he acknowledged that he was part of the Leicester side that won the FA Cup, but he questions Maddison's regular contributions. I think that's a really interesting conversation to have, because he has been missed and he can create chances and he can be a match winner as he was yesterday. I still am not sure about the whole makeup of that midfield in particular, but I mean, we've also continuously questioned whether something has been going on behind the scenes with Maddison and Postecoglou. Are you convinced that he's got a long-term future at Spurs and that he can be the man to inspire the club to silverware?
Well, I thought he was very good, Maddison. In fact, I thought he was excellent in the first half in particular, and a deserving match winner, really, of anyone out there. I think it's particularly encouraging that he's hit the ground running like that, because I think a kind of theme or trend of Maddison's career, really, and we saw it last season, was kind of having these hot streaks, getting injured or falling out of the team, and then not really getting back to the same levels quickly, or to, you know, taking an age to get going again. And last season he was magnificent before that ankle injury against Chelsea in November and that disastrous 4-1, and then he never really got back to the same levels. And so I did think, you know, he picked up this calf injury. You know, is it going to be now a few weeks before we see Maddison kind of back to his best? But he was straight back into the side, which was a bit of a surprise. And he was, as I said, excellent. So great for him. The thing about Maddison, though, and look, I kind of liked that he did the TikTok, because I think it's fun when players show their personalities and when they show a bit of spirit and a bit of fight. But I don't think Roy Keane or kind of anyone else questions the fact that Maddison can be an excellent player on his day. The question with Maddison is, can he consistently do it? And can he kind of drag Spurs through difficult moments? You know, is he the guy who's going to stand up at 2-1 in the second half at the Amex Stadium when Spurs are suddenly on the ropes? And so far, I think it's fair to say at Tottenham, he has shown that brilliant form in one-off games. And the City game in November springs to mind. You know, two goals in that one. He scored against Liverpool as well. So he's scored some big goals this season, Villa as well. But, you know, it's not whether he can do it in one-off games. It's whether he can consistently do it and whether he can be the leader Spurs kind of need, the senior player in difficult moments. And he hasn't shown that so far. I think that's fair. So while I don't have any issue with him kind of hitting back at Roy Keane, I think that's what the celebration was about and obviously what the TikTok was about, I think he now needs to kind of consistent, if he's really to silence his critics, he needs to kind of consistently go on a run, and he needs to be a big player for Spurs in the second half of the season, and kind of help them into the latter stages of the Europa League and help them go on a run in the league, which are obviously the aims now. And yesterday was a very good first step toward doing that, and an encouraging one, but, you know, it's not him doing it yet.
I agree on that point. And I do think whilst Roy Keane's criticism was over the top, it would have stung a bit, because there were some valid points in it, and Dan's kind of articulated it there. It's the lack of consistency. And I know with a playmaking kind of player, by their very nature, they're probably going to be more inconsistent than a defender. It's just harder to create chances and make things happen. It's the harder part of the game, really. But Maddison, for the moments he has shown for Leicester, for Tottenham, for England at times, we know he's got that bit of magic, as Glenn Hoddle likes to say. in his locker, but he just doesn't bring it out often enough. And I kind of disagree with Dan on his performance. I thought he was okay, to be honest. I didn't think really any of the Spurs players were that good yesterday. I thought the only one who was excellent was Spence and Vicario, maybe Danzo. And the goal that Maddison scored was all about Lucas Bergvall for me. It was obviously a cross in from Bentancur, Son, decent connection to whack it back across the box. But the touch that Bergvall takes to trap the deflected Son volley and bring it under control and then get enough on his strike to force Onana into a save that pushes it into the path of Maddison. And maybe he could have claimed it, but it was a good enough hit from Bergvall to make that happen. And then, yeah, you've got to give credit for Maddison for being alive to the danger. But, a lot of players could do that. And I thought overall he was fine. He was okay. Not much more than that for my money. And that was pretty much Spurs all round for me. I mean, like I already said, I think they were quite lucky not to win that game or not concede. So personally, I have to see a lot more of this from improved performances on yesterday, but a lot more sort of game-changing moments from Maddison before I'm won over that he can be the sort of the man that can drive Spurs forward going forward. But also I have no problem with him hitting back. And obviously as a journalist, we enjoy all that kind of stuff. When it comes to Keane's criticism, which, as I said, I think was over the top.
Yeah, I would agree with that. A couple of things there. I thought actually one of his best contributions, aside from scoring, was the brilliant tackle he made just before he was substituted. And you need to see more of that. But the reason I'm not sure that he can do it long term on a regular basis is based on what Ange said a few weeks ago. He said, we need Maddison to be at his 100% fittest to be able to contribute in the way I want. Well, very few players are 100% fit all the time. And just for that reason, I do fear that he's going to flicker in and out and ultimately not be the answer. Although, I mean, he's such a typical Spurs player in so many ways, but I guess being a typical Spurs player equates to not winning silverware either. You mentioned Tom, Jed Spence, and I'll come back to you, Danny Boy, on this one, because I like to take all the credit here. I was the one who said several months ago that why on earth do we have to wait so long to see just how good this guy is? And, Ange Postecoglou, I think, bears a little bit of blame for waiting so long. The way Spence is playing right now, I think he's good enough to be in the England side. Maybe I'm getting a bit carried away, but he was magnificent again yesterday, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, fair play to you, Marcus. I mean, a stop clock is right twice a day, and you did you did get it right on Jed Spence. Yeah, I mean, I think what he's doing at the moment is very impressive. You know, he's man of the match two league games in a row, and deservedly so. He's playing out of position at left back, which I don't think he's done a lot of before. Our colleague Alistair Gold made a point in his piece today, which I thought was interesting, that he might even be better suited to playing left back in a Postecoglou system because he's obviously right-footed and it means he kind of inverts more easily on his stronger foot inside. Whereas if he was playing on the right, he might be more of a kind of touchline-hugging fullback. And perhaps that kind of inversion is one of the reasons that the Postecoglou kind of overlooked him for so long, as well as kind of pretty well documented, I think, sort of off-field stuff as well that have dogged him since he joined Spurs. But look, yeah, he's brilliant, and we've touched on it before, and I think all fans can see it, so I won't kind of go over it in too much detail again, but just his calmness under pressure is remarkable, and just his positivity, I think. You know, he was playing the first half in front of the press box, and just every time he gets the ball, he either looked for a kind of line-breaking forward pass. It didn't always come off, or he looked to just run forward into space and take on his man. And you know, that feels very in keeping with the kind of Postecoglou philosophy. And he made things happen. You know, he took on his man. He gave Mazraoui a really, really difficult afternoon, including kind of really leaving him for dead at one point, kind of turning him inside out and crossing for Son, I think it was. So, yeah, he's doing really, really well. And I think the only sort of area of his game that I think noticeably needs improvement is his crossing on his left foot, which was a bit hit and miss. But again, that's totally understandable. And we're kind of in a position now where, you know, Udogie shouldn't get back in automatically. The Spurs have a midweek game against City after the Ipswich game. And you kind of wonder now, does Postecoglou rest Spence against Ipswich, bring Udogie back in and then play him against City, or vice versa? You know, he's got options now, and I'm really interested to see what he does with them. But I think we can all agree that Spence has been the player of 2025, definitely so far, and probably deserves to be starting the biggest games at the moment.
Yeah, I am. There's a couple of things about Spence that I really like. One is his kind of what Dan was talking about, the composure. It's his big game mentality. Nothing seems to faze him so far. And we spoke to him after that Brentford game. He did talk, you know, about how he just generally is quite a cool, calm, collected character in life. But he really seems to translate that onto the pitch. That's one thing. And the other thing is his skill when running at pace with the ball. Like, that's a hard, hard skill. It's one thing running quickly, you know, off the ball, sprinting into space, but his dribbling ability is really impressive. And I was going to reference that moment against Mazraoui as well that Dan's pointed out. Basically roasted him around the around the outside and had the speed, but also the, as I say, the dribbling ability to power past him and keep the ball under control. And those two qualities are reasons why I am starting to think England is not a pipe dream for Jed Spence. He's only 24. He's playing so well and so consistently at the moment that it seems possible. It seems like he's got those things in his locker that you need right at the top level. And when you consider England's fullback situation, I mean, suddenly from going from so many right backs, you know, really good ones couldn't even get in the squad. Now there's at right back, which is obviously his natural position, although as Dan pointed out, maybe left back might even be more suited. Now right back looks a little bit more open now because obviously Walker seems to be coming to the end. Trippier has retired. Trent's got that one nailed down, but Jarice James can't ever get fit. Ben White, what's going on with him? We're not sure. Suddenly there's options there. At left back, Lewis Hall has made a good sort of case for himself under Lee Carsley, but obviously Tuchel's, you know, in the frame now and or in the job now, and there aren't loads of left backs. So it feels like there is a possibility there and an opportunity there. And just finally about Ange and his role in all this and your probably legitimate criticism of him, Marcus. And I'm kind of agree with you, really. I do think this has happened a little bit more through circumstance than design from his point of view. The injury crisis seems to have, you know, brought Spence into the fold when that didn't really seem to be the plan. But a few sort of fans have pointed out that maybe, and I may be sort of taking the kind of devil's advocate argument here, that perhaps there is more credit due Postecoglou's way than that argument I just gave and the one you're giving, Marcus, that, yeah, he didn't play him earlier, but we know about Spence's previous issues at other clubs. Maybe this is the kind of, I don't know, carrot and stick or whatever approach that has brought the best out of him. Because whatever you say about whether he could have played him earlier, Spence is playing the football of his life under Postecoglou right now. So I guess we'll never really know, like whether, however this approach, whether it could have been done earlier or not. And had it done earlier, it might have had a it might have lessened the risk of injury towards other players from overplaying because Spence wasn't being used. But I do see when people make that argument that perhaps Postecoglou isn't just completely to blame for not using him earlier, and perhaps it's his motivational approach which has managed to get this out of Spence.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair point, and I'm prepared to give Ange Postecoglou the benefit of the doubt over that. The most important thing is that he's playing, he's shining, and we have said several times during this winter of discontent that the big plus has been the development of some of the younger players. I want to come on to Danso and Tell, the two signings, in just a moment as well, and we must touch upon the protest yesterday and what you both made of that. I'll also get you to put your mathematical hats on and try and work out whether Spurs can climb from what has been a precarious position, perhaps back into the European places by the end of the season. As Tom rightly said, they've recorded back-to-back victories for the first time since they beat Manchester United and Brentford earlier in the season, and a trip to Ipswich does offer the possibility of three more points. And by the way, one other interesting stat, it's the first time that we've beaten Manchester United home and away in the league in the same season, doing the double without conceding a goal, which I think is more of a reflection of how bad Manchester United are than anything else. But talking, Dan, of another of the young players who has been magnificent this season, out of position, of course, Archie Gray. Well, I thought yesterday, here's an opportunity for him to play in his best position, somewhere in midfield. But of course, he went with Bentancur, Maddison and Bergvall. And maybe he felt that Gray was tired, needed a little bit of a rest. But almost felt as though it was a bit of a slap in the face for Gray. Here was a chance now for him to be given his preferred berth in the team. Am I reading too much into his exclusion from the starting 11 against United?
Yeah. I mean, Gray's played, I think, every game bar one for 2.5 months. So I think if anyone needed a rest in the squad, it's him. He's done a job at centre-half. He's done a great job at centre-half in the circumstances. And I think he'll have a huge amount of credit in the bank with both Postecoglou and supporters and, frankly, everyone connected with the club. But that doesn't mean he suddenly walks into the midfield when pretty much everyone, I think, in fact, everyone in midfield was available for that game. So no, I don't honestly see it that way, to be honest. I think he'll have to kind of earn his place in midfield over the course of the rest of the season. And we're all kind of interested to see him there. Postecoglou's made the point many times that he's not a centre-half, that he's a midfielder. So I'm intrigued to see what he can do and whether he'll be the number eight or perhaps the number six or somewhere in between. But I don't think he kind of walks in, and I don't think he sort of is owed anything by Postecoglou for sort of having, doing his job and doing it well over the last couple of months.
Okay, but then what is, I mean, obviously he doesn't know at the moment, but at some stage he needs to work it out for the biggest matches. What is Tottenham's best midfield? I mean, Gray has shown what he can do from a defensive point of view. I still think that number six position is up for grabs. We've talked about Maddison, how he flickers in and out. Bentancur was better yesterday, but had, you know, a couple of really poor games in the cup. Bergvall is still developing. Bissouma, I think everyone's starting to lose patience with him. Saar comes and goes a little bit. Tom B, it's a really interesting conundrum as to ultimately what Ange's first choice midfield should, would, will look like.
Yeah, it's hard, isn't it? I just don't think there's really any one midfield that he looks like he's going to settle on for the rest of the season, really. There are too many question marks over pretty much all of them, whether it be inexperience in Bergvall's situation or real lack of consistency in for Bissouma and Bentancur. You know, even when Maddison was fit, he wasn't starting week in, week out. Kulusevski in the middle is probably, when it's going well, as how I like it most personally. But with him playing there, I do feel like they're even more open. And just that's my biggest issue throughout this season, really, has been how open the midfield and easy to play through. And I think that happened again yesterday. Just United didn't make the most of it. And that's something that I feel really needs to be addressed in the summer, whether it is finally giving Gray over pre-season the chance to make the number six position his own. I do keep going into, I mean, you know, despite Dan's response there, I do sort of see where the question comes from over Gray in midfield, because I keep going into games at the moment wondering, will this be the chance where he may get a chance to play in his preferred position? And I guess, but even yesterday when he didn't start and then you thought, will he come off the bench? But then Danzo comes off with a knock. So obviously Gray goes to centre-back. So there were sort of particular circumstances which denied him the chance of going into midfield, but in that particular game. But I think it feels like you're going to be hoping for a lot. What's the phrase? It doesn't feel like Postecoglou is desperate to make that move right now, does it? Playing Gray in midfield. And he's got plenty of time in his whole career going forward for that to happen. But I would almost be surprised at this point if he ended the season sort of regularly in that position, because it just hasn't happened yet. Although having said that, it's obviously due to the injuries. But I don't know. I think it's something they're going to have to really look at in the summer. I think we're going to be having this debate over Tottenham's first choice midfield throughout the rest of the season. Would you agree, Dan? Is there any sort of combination that you go, that's definitely the one? Because I don't see it.
No, I don't know if Postecoglou knows his best midfield setup at the moment, which I think is understandable given the couple of months Spurs have just been through. But yeah, it's something to be worked out, definitely.
I think the other problem, all those players, you know, they have the ability to be really good, but I think it's fair to say none of them are natural leaders. And that is the one quality that this team is clearly lacking when the going gets tough. A lot of really talented players who can thrive when they're 1-0 up or, you know, the situation is favourable, but there isn't that. And there aren't many, of course, in the game, which is why your Roy Keane's and your Patrick Vieira's and all those You know, fantastic leaders are few and far between, but I think that's an area that Spurs really have got to address during the course of the summer. You've mentioned Danso, Tom B, and I'd like to ask both of you about, you know, the fact that throughout January there was wailing and there was gnashing of teeth. Spurs are, you know, being slow in the transfer market again. Well, ultimately they did bring in Danso and Tell. And Tell obviously started. He's obviously scored already against Aston Villa in the FA Cup. I think maybe, although it was a little late in the month, Dan rightly said that all the business comes at the end of January. I think it's perhaps fair to say that Spurs have done quite well again in that regard. Dan, how impressed have you been with both Danso and Tell so far?
So it's early days, so I don't want to draw kind of any really sweeping conclusions, but on Danso, I think he looks like a really good fit. I've been impressed with him. I've been impressed by how quickly he's kind of settled into the challenge at hand in a way that Dragišin hasn't. And I feel bad digging out Dragišin because the poor bloke's got a cruciate ligament injury. But in a way that he hasn't, he looks a good fit for the system, Danso. You know, he looks like he's happy playing on the halfway line. Whereas I always think Dragišin's looked happier when he's kind of on the edge of his own box or even on the edge of his own six-yard box. He's quick. We saw that with that covering tackle on Højlund, I think it was. He's kind of decent enough on the ball and he looks kind of happy to take his chances of bringing the ball out. You know, when he sees the gap, he'll kind of carry it out of defence. And I think all those things make him a good fit for a Postecoglou side. So it was sort of easy when he signed, when Spurs kind of hijacked Wolves' deal to think, you know, is this a panic buy or is this just a piece of opportunism? But he looks like a, you know, as I said, just a good player for A, the Premier League, and B, a kind of progressive team, an Postecoglou team. So, yeah, encouraged by him early on. And Tell, I don't think he's ready to be a Premier League centre forward. I think his hold-up play was not great yesterday and he really struggled to kind of link the play and keep hold of the ball. And that contributed to spells of United pressure where Spurs couldn't really play out because they were going to him and he was losing it and then United would come again. But I think that's kind of understandable. He's three games in, he's 19. And I do think he's looked lively. He had lots of shots yesterday, kind of half chances and chances with both feet. It looks like, you know, he feels like a bit like a coiled spring who could kind of come alive at any minute. But my sense is that that's more likely to happen when he's playing from the wing, probably from the left. So when Solanke and or Richarlison are back, I could see him being kind of the Son alternative potentially, with maybe Odegaard and Johnson providing the directness on the right and Son and Tell kind of rotating from the left. I mean, it's a nice thought, isn't it? And it's, yeah, again, it's kind of good problems for Postecoglou to have there.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, sorry, Tom, I was just going to say, you mentioned Solanke, and we knew this actually when he was playing, but it's often only when you're out of the side that a player is fully appreciated, and his link-up play has been so good. So, yeah, the options are there again. Obviously, Johnson came off the bench. Great to see Odegaard back in first-team action as well. Tom, are you excited by the newcomers?
Yeah. Interesting about Tell and sort of Dan's comments on his suitability to play through the middle. And I can't disagree that yesterday's performance wasn't exactly, you know, blowing us away in terms of his ability to do that. But what I found quite interesting was that he played the whole game and he played the whole game through the middle. So obviously when he signed, there was a lot of talk in Germany that he was really after a centre forward position. Now, that doesn't mean he's going to play there all the time. As Dan pointed out, when Solanke's back, he could be maybe even better out wide. But against Villa, for most of the game, he was playing wide left and some was through the middle. And obviously it changed towards the end of the game and it didn't really work. And I think we've all sort of looked at Son this season and felt like he hasn't really worked through this at centre forward, even if he was actually pretty good there in the first half of last season. And so the fact that he stayed there the whole time yesterday almost feels like Postecoglou's gone, right, here's your chance. And he kept on the whole game. I kept thinking, is he going to be withdrawn? Because he wasn't really having that much of an impact. But it almost felt like Postecoglou was saying, look, here's your chance. Told you you're going to play games. I'm proving it to you now. play your way in, get your chance while, you know, Solanke is injured, and try and adapt quickly, I suppose, and give yourself the best possible chance to get up to speed in double quick time. And yes, yesterday suggested it, you know, he's a bit of a way off from really making a big impact in that position, but it feels like Spurs are going to give him all the opportunity to do that, which I think is quite exciting. It might be that, you know, a week's worth of training this week out of Ipswich with his new teammates could really, I wouldn't be surprised if we saw a marked improvement next week. And then as for Danso, I mean, I know it's a bit harsh to sort of look back on his time at Southampton when he was only 20, but that was the last time I saw him, and I witnessed him come off the bench against Leicester in that infamous 9-0. To be honest, I didn't really focus too much on him because it was just a mad game all around, and by then the game was completely gone. But the difference in player just shows you how much you can develop throughout your career, and how, I guess, it sort of underlines how exciting some of the potential we've seen some of the youngsters in Spurs squad, and how the ages that a lot of them are, how much if they're progressed in the right way through good coaching and patience and everything, how good they could go on to be. Because when you see the likes of Bergvall and Archie Gray producing what they are now, how good could they be in the future? Because Danso, the player that I saw at Southampton at 20, who's older than both of those are now, was nothing compared to what I've seen in the few games so far. I really like his pace. I really like his ambition with the ball and his passing. I mean, yesterday he was a few loose passes, but he's trying those kind of ambitious, progressive passes off the pitch. And I just agree wholeheartedly with Dan about how much he feels like a clever signing in terms of how much he suits the way Postecoglou wants to play.
Yeah, I mean, we oscillate, don't we, between absolute doom and gloom and great excitement about the future. But I think you're right, Tom. There is so much potential. Postecoglou said it a few weeks ago. He said, "I'm so excited by the youth and some of the, you know, the younger players at this club. I just hope I'm around in 3 years to benefit from that." And that, of course, is the big question. But is this going to be the turning point? I'm looking at the league table, Danny Boy. Spurs having flirted with the relegation zone. Oh, Tom A was absolutely right. It's a good talking point. The media will love it. Spurs are not going to be relegated. And, of course, back-to-back wins now means we're definitely not going to be relegated. But can we climb into, you know, eighth place, which I think will probably be good enough for the Conference League? We've got 30 points from 25 played. At the moment, Fulham are in eighth position with 39 points. So 9 points off the pace with 13 games still to go. I think it's potentially doable. Whether they want to do it and be in the Conference League again next season, I don't know. And obviously, the deeper Spurs go in the Europa League, then that becomes less likely. But am I getting carried away here off the back of successive wins that Spurs could yet launch themselves into a top eight position?
I suppose that's got to be the aim in the league, if they're aiming for anything really, apart from being in a good condition for the Europa League. So yeah, it's doable. I mean, they're playing Fulham in a couple of weeks, so that's maybe a six-pointer for that sort of eighth spot. But I think really, talk of a turning point is too premature. I mean, we've had that so many times under Postecoglou and this season already that I've kind of learned my lesson on it. But a big problem Spurs have had is not following up good results and big results with, you know, good performances the following game. And, you know, we arguably saw that again against Brentford. I know it was a huge ask to go to Liverpool and get something, but a really good back-to-the-wall performance was just followed by a really kind of meek display and then a really chaotic one against Villa. So before I start talking about turning points, I do think Spurs need to, you know, follow it up. They need to put like a little mini streak together of good results and performances before I think we can say that a corner's been turned. I mean, I guess what I will say is kind of perception-wise, I do think we're entering a new phase of the season. Like, as anyone who's listened to this podcast regularly will know, like, I have genuinely found it quite difficult to really be too critical about the team. I know you haven't held back on occasion, Marcus, but I think deferring judgment on Spurs during the injury crisis was kind of fair enough. Obviously, there is the question about how culpable Postecoglou is, but it was a dire situation where I think any manager in any club would have struggled. So it was tough to kind of say, you know, they need to be doing better here. But now I think that is kind of coming to an end. The players are back. They're still missing their best centre backs and their two centre forwards against United. But you know, it felt like a much healthier position to be in. He's got options. He's got selection dilemmas, as we touched on. So the time for kind of deferring judgment, I think, is over. And I'm kind of very interested to see what Spurs can do, particularly in the Europa League, but also in their remaining 13 Premier League games, as you said. I don't think it's sort of beyond the realms that they sneak into eighth place, but I think it will be a big ask given kind of how they've struggled for consistency so far.
Yeah, well, the Europa League, of course, is what it's all about. And Galatasaray's heavy defeat the other night has potentially smoothed Tottenham's progress towards the latter stages of that. Tom B, one other thing I particularly want to ask you about, because, you were both at the game yesterday, but what was your sense of the protest and whether there's going to be any sort of, quote, positive outcome from what you saw out on the streets of Tottenham High Road yesterday?
Yeah, it was fascinating. I walked from Seven Sisters yesterday rather than getting the train to Watt Hart Lane, which I normally do. And I normally get there a few hours before the game anyway, like most of us do. And I walked past where the sort of demonstration was congregating, this demonstration that's been organised by Change for Tottenham, a protest group against the ownership. And it was about 2:30, perhaps. And I don't think they were meeting properly till 2:45, having this march at 3:00. And there were a few hundred people at that point. But I sort of thought, okay, this seems quite similar to the one ahead of the Liverpool game, however many months ago that was. I'm sort of wondering how big a thing this is going to be, because there's been a lot of talk about it. Both myself and Dan and other outlets have done interviews with people involved in that organisation in the lead up to the game. So it feels like there's been a lot more coverage of it going into the ahead of the game. And then at about 3:10, I was at Spurs and I went up onto a bit of a vantage point outside the stadium looking down. And I have to say, I was quite surprised to see just so many fans take to the streets. I mean, I think a conservative estimate was 2,000, but I would not be surprised if it was more, seeing them all march down towards the stadium with obviously all their banners. And I think it's fair to say it felt quite a significant protest. It felt like one that that other fans of other clubs will have noticed rather than just fans within the Tottenham fan base. So they'd certainly made their voices heard. During the game itself, they had sort of promised that they wouldn't try and disrupt it with too many anti-ownership chants, which, to be honest, there've been loads of those in the away games, as we saw particularly at Aston Villa the other day. I mean, that game from the off was very, very strong in terms of the anti-Daniel Levy and ownership chanting throughout the match. And then there was the sit-in after the game, which I only sort of hung around for sort of 5-10 minutes because I had to go to the press conference. But it felt like there were a few hundred people involved in that. Obviously, the fans were all in different parts of the stadium, so trying to congregate in the south stand wasn't probably as easy as getting them all together at the head of the march. So it felt like overall it was the march ahead of the game that was the most eye-catching. And I think it felt like it had an impact. It definitely... as I say, took me by surprise, the scale of it.
Okay, it had an impact, but Dan, are there going to be any consequences? What if anything will happen as a result of it?
Well, I think it was a starting point, Marcus. I don't think we can expect Daniel Levy to kind of march out the boardroom, announce that he's selling the club and start apologising to fans. So I think it has to go down as an kind of encouraging starting point. I mean, as Tom says, that was the most consequential protest of its kind against the Spurs board in 24 years of Enoch. I think I wasn't covering the club, but I don't believe there were kind of any before the last 10 years when I have been doing the job. There have been protests against the Super League. There have been protests against kind of the move to Stratford, but they were kind of specific sort of one issue protests. This was a kind of protest against Daniel and the running of the club. So I think that is significant. And I was not surprised is the wrong word because I don't know what I was expecting, but it was interesting to see that, as Tom says, there were at least kind of 2,000 fans there. I think it will be result dependent to a degree in that, and Postecoglou said this, but if Spurs go on a brilliant run now in the league and go deep in the Europa League, naturally some of the resentment and frustration toward the board will kind of die down. But I think this is about more than just the current situation Spurs are in. You know, it's about a feeling that the club is not doing what, you know, as much as it can to make this side into a winning team on the pitch. And, you know, that's obviously reflected in the wages to turnover ratio and a few other things. So fans will have different reasons for their frustrations. You know, there'll be different things over the last 24 years that have, you know, particularly gotten people's sort of got under people's skin. But, you know, I think generally, you know, there is a kind of anti-board and anti-Levy feeling at the moment. And, you know, this definitely has the potential to be a kind of starting point and grow into something more. So I'm interested to see, you know, if that happens and where it goes.
Yeah. And I mean, what I've noticed over the past few days, there have, I think, been a few little leaks. There's been a big thing on the BBC about, you know, those who've worked with Daniel Levy, what he feels about it, et cetera, and I think trying to spread a little bit of positivity. What I find extraordinary, and you guys obviously are at the club all the time, so you'll know more. And I do know that Daniel Levy is not a natural communicator, but I think the silence from the top of the club is, well, it speaks volumes, but it's also a massive PR own goal. Quite why Levy, or, I mean, I don't know who else, you know, close to him could just come out and talk themselves, explain where they are, what they feel about the whole process, have a little bit of dialogue. Now, I'm not suggesting that you go down the route of American football clubs, and I've made this analogy before with my other appalling team that I support, the Dallas Cowboys, and Jerry Jones, their owner, he's on his radio program every week. You know exactly what he's thinking, what he's feeling, what he's wanting. If only Daniel Levy could do that with a little more regularity and sound human and put his point across, I think Spurs could alleviate a lot of this trouble. But it's the constant silence and the seeming lack of respect for the fans from the hierarchy, which I think is causing so much trouble. Because a lot of what Levy has done has been really good. I mean, we all know about the stadium and everything else. If he just had a bit more savvy with regards to the public relations side of things, I think he could alleviate a lot of this. But Tom, is that going to happen? Is he going to see the light in that regard?
Well, I think that would help, to be honest. I do think maybe having a different voice, and particularly if it was himself giving an interview, that would go some way. But it's interesting. I come at this as a neutral who's only covered the club for the last 3 years. Obviously, know a lot about Spurs, but not you know, throughout my life, because they're a big club, but not to the level historically as you guys and other fans out there. And I suppose I look at the last 3 years and the money that's been spent on transfers, the fantastic stadium, and I compare it to other ownerships, and I can sort of see the point that I guess Jermaine Defoe was kind of making on Sky yesterday of how Daniel Levy might be feeling. But also it seems like that wage to turnover argument seems to be one that a lot of fans are sort of leaping on as a sort of indication of the lack of ambition. I don't know. It's interesting. I do feel like I don't really see why maybe they couldn't do an interview. And whilst I'm not sure if it's, maybe at this point it's too far gone, because the depth of feeling against the ownership seems to be so strong at the moment, maybe it wouldn't make a difference. But I don't know, you'd be surprised sometimes when, as you're saying, when people sort of show people what they're really thinking and give a window into the decisions they make and why they make them, people can sometimes have a different point of view or empathize with it, or at least understand a bit better. And I do think there is a power in that. So I would hope that would be the case, and not just as a journalist, because that would be interesting because we never hear from Daniel Levy. And to be honest, you remember when Paratici came in, he was so used to in Italy speaking every week to the media, and we were hoping there might be something similar. But then as soon as you come to England, because it's just not our culture to have sporting directors do things with the media, that completely went away as soon as he didn't have to do it, basically. So part of it isn't just Tottenham at all. It's just the way we do things in England. And it feels like that needs to change to make them change. But until that happens, I don't really sense an interest from the ownership in doing that, even if I personally feel like that might actually go some way to healing some of these rifts.
Well, Mr. Levy, the offer is open to come onto the Tottenham Way podcast, and we will be, you know, very amenable to that. Tell us your side of things. If Donna Cullen's listening, come on, somebody, use your common sense, spread a bit of love about the place. Danny Boy, anything else you wish to refer to before you get back on the training ground ahead of another blank week in Tottenham's calendar?
No, and I'm just glad that Spurs aren't the crisis club in the Premier League or in London this week. So I'm hoping it's going to be a little bit quieter and I can kind of defrazzle ahead of the Ipswich game.
Yeah, it makes a change. I mean, we think we've got problems. Have a look at Manchester United and, oh, poor old Arsenal. Injury concerns. It is happening, as Anne said, it's going to happen to a lot of clubs. It will. The question is, how do you deal with it? Can you be adaptable? Dan Kilpatrick of The Standard, thank you very much indeed. Tommy B, Tom Barkley from The Sun, thank you. Hope you feel better before your weekend trip to Suffolk. I'm sure that Tom A will rejoin the fold either before that game, if we do preview it, or certainly afterwards. Back-to-back wins, things looking a little more promising. Players coming back as well. Fingers crossed. I'm Marcus Buckland. Come on, you Spurs.